This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli of TVWorthWatching.com, in for Terry Gross. In a bit, we'll hear from Fred Armisen of Saturday Night Live and Carrie Brownstein of the band Slater, Kinney, and Wild Flag, talking about their sketch comedy show Portlandia. But first, we're going to hear Terry's interview with Pamela Adlon. She's performed the voices for lots of animated TV characters, including that of Bobby on King of the Hill, for which she won an Emmy. Adlon also has worked on Louis C.K.'s live-action comedy TV series as both an actress and a consulting producer. Currently, Pamela Adlon is co-starring in the Showtime series Californication, which, as the title suggests, is obsessed with sex. A note to parents. The Californication clip we're about to hear is slightly racy, but the conversation that follows is not explicit. In the season premiere of Californication, which airs on Sunday, January 8th, Pamela Adlon's character, Marcy Runkle, is recently divorced and remarried. In this scene from the first season of Californication, Marcy is still in her first marriage and has just had a fling with another woman. She's talking about that with her friend, played by Natasha McElhone, whom we'll hear first.
So you're done with the lesbitarian experiment? Mm-hmm.
The grass is always greener, mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. Isn't that how you ended up engaged to be buried?
Hey, no bill bashing. You promised me. Stay on the subject.
That is the subject. Married people bored out of their minds looking for some strange. It never solves what was wrong in the first place.
Oh, like you're such an expert. So that's Pamela Adlon in a scene from Californication. Pamela Adlon, welcome to Fresh Air. It was so difficult
to find
a scene from that show that we could play on the radio.
Oh, my God.
It is all about sex.
So I was wondering.
When you took the role, did you wonder what you were getting yourself into?
Oh, not at all. I mean, this show was a happy accident, I like to call, like, my first daughter, because I mean it in the best way. It was one of those things where they offered me a role in the pilot, and it was one tiny little scene. I was never meant to be in the show, and I kind of did the pilot and went through, like, a whole pilot season, and Tom Kapanos, when the show got picked up, he just kept writing for me, and it was just this gift. He kept giving me this gift and kind of, shepherding this character of Marcy for me, and it just became a thing. I never thought it would go to the dirty, filthy place it went to, but it never, I don't think that there's anything too morally reprehensible going on, because there is, like, this emotional, wonderful core, which is the family. And then also, it's funny. It's not dark without being funny. So I'm not really a fan of darkness without funny.
So your character, Marcy, is having a sexual renaissance this season. What have her issues been?
Oh, my God.
For the radio, yes.
She's gone through a lot of different things with drugs and sex and with her husband and, going through breakup and divorce and cheating and, friends cheating around her and, living in corrupt ways, horribly morally corrupt ways. But, at the kind of center of it all, she really loves Charlie, and he really loves her. Like, they're always drawn to each other. I think that
Charlie is the husband from whom she separated but now has a child with.
That's right.
Because she found out she was pregnant after they split.
Exactly.
So did you have to set boundaries for what you were willing to do and unwilling to do on the show?
Well, I remember one season, I think it was at the beginning of last season, I got the first script, and I was in New York at the time, and I read it, and I was like, oh my God, I can't do this. I mean, you have to remember, Terry, I have three daughters, and so I sit there and I say, okay, what are they going to see? What do they have access to? My oldest daughter's in high school now, and so I kind of wrote an email to Tom Kapanos, and I said, I just have a question about the first scene and the thing that's happening to me in that scene. I'm like, does it really have to be like that in that vantage point? And he means, oh, you mean the funny part? So basically, that was my answer. It was like, shut up and go to work. Because in my email, I was like, you know, I've always been a team player. I go for it. Always take it for the team. So, but we somehow always get through it, and I never have to do something that's awful, you know. And we always get through it together. And I know my crew really well. And Natasha is one of my best friends in the world, and David, and just we're all very close, and we don't get to do enough of them, as far as I'm concerned.
And so, what's it like having to give your daughter talks about either abstinence or birth control or, you know, whatever your talk with her is, knowing the show that you're on? Everybody is sexually obsessed on that program.
Yeah, it's true, but it's really funny because it's not even my oldest daughter who's so aware of it. My kids are 14, 11, and 8. They're all girls. And I'm a single mom. And so we were in a video store, and my 11-year-old, who was probably 9 at the time, said, "Mama, Mama, come over here." And she takes me over to the section where there's a whole bunch of Californication. She pulls out a DVD, she shows me the back, and it's me on all fours being spanked by my husband in lingerie, by my show husband. And she's like, "Mama, that's so funny." And so my 9-year-old at the time is laughing at it with my 6-year-old. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to vomit. I could either just be like, act very European and like, "Well, this is the human body. It's a thing of beauty." And, you know, and I just was like, "All right, just put it back." It was a silly thing. We were playing a game in the show, and it's not what it... It's like pin the tail on the donkey. It's nothing what you think. Put it back.
That's so funny. What kind of reactions do you get from viewers who recognize you on the street?
I like the passionate reactions I get because of the shows and the things that I've been involved with, that people are very excited. I took my daughters to Alvin Ailey yesterday in the city.
And the dance company.
Yeah, it was unbelievable. And it was just, I was crying hysterically. We finished watching the show. And then all of a sudden, I have this new demographic. I had these ladies from, I had their 20-year-old daughters, and then these 60-year-old moms and a grandma. And they were like, "Mossy! Oh my God, it's Mossy!" And they were screaming and freaking out. And then, you know, I don't think I have a demographic. Like, I was at Comic-Con in San Diego recently, and I was doing a signing, and my line was just like all military guys, young girls, like housewives, and guys in wheelchairs. Just, I don't know what. There was just everybody all over the place, and they were like, they were there for the animation and like the Japanese anime stuff, and then the Louis stuff, and then, of course, the King of the Hill stuff. And the Californication stuff. So I don't know. It's a weird kind of life.
But you've just touched on something so interesting about your career. I mean, you were first known for voiceover work in cartoons and for playing Bobby Hill on King of the Hill, an animated series. Then you get to do Lucky Louie, Louis C.K.'s first TV series. And then you're on Californication. So you're on this incredibly adult cable show. And at the same time, you're famous for all these, like, children's cartoon shows. And are there two more opposite extremes?
Yeah, you know, there's been points where, you know, I'll go do a table reading for King of the Hill in the morning. And then I'll go to the set of Californication and do something, you know, insidiously dirty. And then I'll go record maybe a Tinkerbell movie or something like that. Or the next day I'll go do Phineas and Ferb, which is, you know, one of the kids' shows that I do. It's just, you know, it's normal to me. Like, if I am in a studio with Tom Kenny, who is a great friend of mine who plays SpongeBob, or, you know, all the guys that I've come up with in animation, what's going on in those studios in between takes is the dirtiest moment you could ever experience in your life. You know what? is really funny. I always say that the Californication set is like the most chaste, non-flirtatious, unromantic set you could ever imagine. I mean, we're walking around in bathrobes and like people are saying, you know, oh, you know, who are you having sex with today? And nobody's really doing anything. I've never seen anybody flirt. Nobody comes on to anybody. But when I'm doing, you know, one of my cartoon things, somebody's always like, hey, Pammy. What's going on? Saying a bad thing. And a Californication, it's boring. There's nothing going on hot at all.
I think it's compensation.
Probably.
The fact that you're so exposed in the actual shooting.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, you're trying on Agent Provocateur lingerie and underwear that like I've never worn in my life because I dress like a boy personally in my life, and then I'm putting these things on, looking at my costume designer Peggy going, oh my god, I can't wear this, please kill me, I'm in my 40s, I have 3 daughters.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Pamela Adlon, and she plays Marcy in the Showtime series Californication. She was Louis C.K.'s wife in the series Lucky Louis, and she plays his good friend, a single mother, in his current series Louis. And she's done lots and lots of animated characters, including Bobby Hill in the long-lived series King of the Hill.
Yes,
so,
ma'am.
How did you start working with Louis C.K.?
Well, Louis and I met for the pilot of Lucky Louis at HBO. And a lot of people think we knew each other before, but that's actually where we met and forged this friendship. And we just connected and had really strong alchemy working partnership from the get and really just got each other and were able to come up with some amazing stuff together. It was extremely fulfilling. It was like doing community theater.
Let's play a scene from Louis. And you're a single mother, and you meet Louis through your kids because he has 2 daughters. Then you start hanging out together and becoming good friends. And at the end of last season, Louis decided he wanted to be more than friends with you, and you basically told him that's never going to happen. So in this scene, he's taken you to a very nice restaurant, the kind of restaurant he usually would not go to. So here's Pamela Adlon and Louis C.K.
Why did you want to come here?
It's a good place.
Did you want to take me here because it looks Frenchy and cool looking?
No. I mean...
Have you ever eaten here?
Yeah.
When? Meyer? You picked it out because you thought that I would think you were cool, which you're not. You need to face it. You are very, very uncool, Louis, and you're very boring.
Yeah, well, you're not exactly...
Yes, I am exactly. Come on, you think I'm awesome. I think you're okay. It's just the way it is. We need to admit that or just walk away.
Okay. I wish the food would come.
Why?
Because I'm starving.
Really, you're starving? You can't just be hungry for a second. Is your life going to end? You have to constantly shove bread in your hole.
Well, I don't have to. I have to.
Uh-huh. That's my guest, Pamela Adlon and Louis C.K. in an episode from Louis. Your character is so abrasive and blunt. She doesn't filter what she's thinking. Are you that way?
I think, yeah. I mean, that's my relationship with Louis, certainly. I do have a filter. I know how to control myself. because I have 3 kids and I live in the world, and my kids did start out the year going to Lutheran school this year. I had to definitely learn how to use my filter more, but... Yeah, that's pretty much Louis and my relationship in real life, that we like to really make fun of each other and be merciless with each other. And it's very delightful and fulfilling.
Now, you're also known for doing the voice of Bobby on King of the Hill. And he's what, 11 or 12 when the series starts?
Yeah, he was 12 for about 12 years, and then he turned 13 for, I think, 1 year.
So So this is an animated series. Were they looking for a woman to do his voice, kind of like Nancy Cartwright does the voice of Bart Simpson? Or were they looking for a male to do it, but you auditioned anyways?
Well, the thing is about the phenomenon about women playing boys is that we're not going to age and we're not going to go through puberty in the middle of, you know, a long-running series, what people will hope will be long-running. And I used to, you know, take over for a lot of boys whose voices would crack and change. It's just a kind of a thing where, you know, I have my voice is on the lower resonance scale. So I just naturally go into the boy mode. And I don't know. I mean, there was something about, you know, doing his voice.
How did you create the voice of Bobby Hill? Because he's a 12-year-old boy from Texas, and you're, you know, a woman from New York who sounds like you're from New York.
Do I? Well,
you are
this
from New
is
York,
what
right?
happened. I am.
Okay.
It's also my mother's English. So my dad's from Boston and my mother's English, and they met at the USO in Paris. So that's one of the crazier things. But no, it was just a casting like any other. And you walk in and they said, well, he's a young boy from Texas and here's the sides. And I just was thinking in my head, oh, damn it. I wish I'd watched Badlands last night. I wish I knew that I could prepare myself and had a Sissy Spacek marathon, something. But you just kind of wing it and pull it out of your butt, which is what all of animation is about. You literally never see script or sides. And you walk in and they're like, okay, I'm going to call Pam in for this because I need the mom, an army man, and the boy who lives up the street, and also Walla for dads. So I can basically cover all of that. And, you know, you work with a lot of the same directors in voiceover and animation because people tend to know where you can, what you can offer and how many voices you can do. And you could end up doing at least 3 voices a session, which is what is optimal for people. And also people want to get in and out as quick as possible.
So can you do the voice of Bobby Hill again and tell us how you created that voice?
Well, yes, ma'am. Yes, Miss Gross. I went into the audition and I just kind of, I think that my original Bobby was like, he was like slower and he would say, okay. And he was kind of more of a depressed sounding person. And then Bobby got a little more hyper and he would be like, I want to be a prop comic, Dad. And can I stay home and watch an after-school special? It's about Jesus.
You know, just be different kind of things. It's, I don't know, it's one of the things I learned in animation is you never, ever want to start doing a voice that you can't sustain for 4 straight hours. And I learned that when I was doing, like, a female Yoda character and she was talking like this in the Federation, you see, and it's like... I still can't do it. It tickles. It tickles the back of my throat so bad. And I'm like, okay, I'm never going to do that again. You can't basically start a voice that you can't do all day.
Let's hear a scene from King of the Hill in which you play the 12-year-old Bobby Hill. And this is from the episode for which you won your Emmy. Let me just start by saying Bobby's father, Hank, is a real, like, old-fashioned kind of man. You know, he likes to like home repairs and sports and being out with the guys and having a beer. And Bobby is not fulfilling Hank's expectations of manhood. You know, he's not athletic. He's like short. He's pudgy. He has a lot of friends who are girls. So in this episode, Bobby's gotten bullied by a bunch of boys, and they've not only beaten him up, they forced him literally to eat dirt. So, you know, he wants to take a self-defense course, but the only self-defense course around is a self-defense class for women that's being offered at the Y. So he enrolls. He's the only male in the class, with the exception of the guy who is like the model. He's the guy who the women in the class are supposed to practice their self-defense techniques on. So in this scene, it starts with Bobby walking into the class for the first time, and the first voice that we hear is the instructor.
Are you sure you're in the right class? This is women's self-defense.
Please, miss, all the other courses are full.
I'm sorry, it's for women only. We're trying to maintain a certain comfort level here.
But I hate men as much as you.
I don't hate men. I just hate being a victim.
I hate being a victim, too. Look, I was at a girl's slumber party last night when three men pushed me to the ground and made me eat dirt.
Okay, you can stay. Now grab a whistle and prepare to be empowered! Most women who are attacked are subdued by verbal threats. Today we're going to get used to hearing these threats, keeping our cool, and practicing some responses of our own to the most vulnerable areas of a man's anatomy.
Shut up and give me your purse!
I don't know you! That's my purse! Okay, I want everybody to try it. You first. See, I don't hate men.
Give me your purse! Now!
That's my purse.
Don't be afraid to shout it. That's my purse! Try it again.
That's my purse! I don't know you!
That's really funny with Bobby Hill. Hill having to say, that's my purse. So of all the great episodes that you've done of King of the Hill, why do you think you won the Emmy for that one?
I think that I actually did at least three voices in that episode as well. And that's, I found out that that's the way a lot of the judging is done. Hank Azaria, I think he's won multiple Emmys for Simpsons. And it's really the scope. They don't look at a whole series, which is crazy. They look at one episode. And so within one episode, I played Bobby. I think I played Chain Wasana Song.
Do the voices for us as you mentioned the characters.
So I played Bobby Hill. I played Chain Wasana Song. The chain train stops for the ladies. And I also played a character called Clark Peters. And, he was very kind of asthmatic. And I think I did a woman somewhere or whatever. I mean, in that episode, that was Ashley Gardner. But I think it's about like the scope of voices that you do. Besides, you know, every once in a while, somebody like Mel Gibson for the Braveheart episode of The Simpsons will win an Emmy because of that being the thing. But, you know, it was kind of me winning an Emmy for King of the Hill was a big victory for voiceover people. That's what I felt. I felt like I was representing my community, my VO community that doesn't get recognized a lot. So that felt really, really good. And I was able to say every single person's name who does voices on the show. It was a really great day. It was exciting.
So did you take voice lessons so that you could learn how to do many different voices, many different characters without shredding your voice?
No, I didn't. I mean, I realize when I think back on my life, I was always imitating the cartoons that I would see. Like, I would want to be, like, a really good mimic. And then in terms of voiceover, the man who's still my agent, he's called Paul Doherty, he brought me in because he heard my voice in something. And he said, read this copy. And it was a 7-Eleven campaign. And he said, you're a young Kevin. And I said, but this is a boy. And he said, yeah, just trust me. Just read this. And that was my first campaign that I booked. And I did it for years. And it just opened up all these doors. That's funny because I started in radio. And I could not get arrested in animation. I just only did radio ads. And then I got into animation, and I can't book a radio spot to save my life now. It's completely the opposite.
So you started in animation by doing radio ads portraying a boy.
That's correct. And when I also think about my career...
Did you change your voice for it, or did you just do it as yourself?
Yeah, I would be like, hey, Dad, can I borrow the car? Like, there's just something, you know, inherently boyish about my voice. And I this is an older Kevin, and this would be a younger Kevin. Like, if somebody said, can you pitch it up? Can you make him 8 years old? Okay, Mom. Yeah. Gee, you know. Or there, you know, you'd hear, like, women. Like, I mean, there's really, like, notoriously
I don't want to put anybody down, but you remember Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and the old Rankin Bass, you know, that kind of claymation stuff. And the guy who was Felix, like, it was so obviously a, you know, a lady who'd be like, gee, I want a lollipop, you know, like that kind of thing. So I kind of tried to take it into a more natural range, you know, but it's the kind of thing where I started out, you know, I've been acting since I was 9 years old. And so when I was a teenager, I was doing tons of, you know, sitcoms, you know, like on Night Court, I played a little boy that Bull adopted. He thought I was a little boy, but I was, of course, I was a girl pretending to be a boy. So some guy would be my foster dad. And I worked with Red Fox as, you know, I was cast. I went through the whole casting process in drag. As my maiden name is Siegel, so I went through as Paul Siegel, and I went through all the ranks and even tested at Network as Paul Siegel. And Red Fox was like, I knew you were a girl, like from the beginning. But I literally did that pilot for the first three quarters of the episode as Tony Rutledge. Hey, Mr. Hughes, you know, it's cool here. And then three quarters of the way through, Rosanna DeSoto finds me in the bathroom and outs me as a girl. And Selma Diamond finds me in the bathroom on Night Court and she outs me as a girl. And that was literally like my whole 80s oeuvre was me in drag on camera. And then I became famous for doing that in animation.
So did you ever want to be a boy when you were growing up?
I was just very tomboyish. I always felt more, you know, planted in kind of a boy energy. I love men, you know. I mean, it's just, I feel like a boyish girl, but a lot of people are like, oh, Pammy, you're such a girl. But, you know, that's just who I am. I always, like, wore my brother's hand-me-downs. And when I was pregnant with my first daughter, I did a photo shoot with this lady, and it was the whole theme was a pregnant boy. So, you know, it's me with my hands handcuffed behind my back with a chain link fence. It's crazy.
Did a lot of people assume you must be a lesbian because you had such
a God,
masculine?
Oh, God, yes. Uh-huh. I'm sure. I hope people still do. I don't want to ruin anybody's, you know, thought they have in their head about me.
So it must be especially true since you're invisible in so many of your roles. It's wonderful to have people just create whatever they think.
Absolutely. I'm open to all of it. I love it all. And I want my kids, my daughters to live that way. I don't want everybody to, you know, say, oh, you have to be a certain way or whatever. It's just, it's always been that way. I won an Emmy for King of the Hill when I was pregnant with my third daughter. And I desperately didn't want to wear a dress that pregnant. I never want to wear a dress. Never, ever want to wear a dress. And so somebody made something really fabulous and kind of boyish and flowy in a nice way for me that I was able to pull off. They try to pull off girl things. It wasn't a dress. No.
Pants?
Yeah, it was like pants-ish. It was like a cool, like, pantsuit with Herman Munster kind of shoes. I was never wearing heels then. Now I'll put a heel on once in a while.
Well, good for you. I don't understand why women are expected to wear a dress just because it's formal.
No, I hate it. I hate it. And, you know, growing up, I think part of it is when I was in elementary school, I think that I got into a fight one day with a kid, like in second or third grade. I used to get into a lot of little mix-ups. I was a little toughy. And I think it was the only day of my entire life I was wearing a dress, and I felt like I had no power. That's just me. That's who I am. Like, I need pants and short nails to feel in my body powerful. I'm not making a judgment on anyone else. That's just me.
Pamela Adlon speaking with Terry Gross. The season premiere of Californication airs Sunday, January 8th on Showtime. Now we're going to listen to Terry's interview with Fred Armisen and Carrie Brownstein, the co-creators and stars of the sketch comedy series Portlandia, which just began its second season on IFC. Fred Armisen has been a cast member of Saturday Night Live for 10 years and is probably best known for his portrayal of Barack Obama. Carrie Brownstein is a guitarist and singer who co-founded the bands Slater Kinney and Wild Flag. Portlandia is set in Portland, Oregon, where Carrie Brownstein lives. It satirizes people who are trying to do the right thing and live a healthy, environmentally, and politically correct lifestyle. In this sketch from Portlandia, Fred Armisen's character has just returned to L.A. from a trip to Portland. He's trying to tell Carrie Brownstein's character why Portland is so special. That description turns into a music video.
Do you remember the 90s?
Yeah.
You know, people were talking about getting piercings and getting tribal tattoos.
Yeah.
And people were singing about saving the planet and forming bands.
Yeah.
There's a place where that idea still exists as a reality, and I've been there.
Where is it?
Portland.
Oregon?
Yeah. Dream of the 90s is alive. Portland, Portland, Portland. The dream of the 90s is alive. Portland, Portland. The tattoo ink never runs dry. Remember when people were content to be unambitious, sleep till 11, just hang out with their friends? I mean, they had no occupations whatsoever, maybe working a couple hours a week at a coffee shop.
Right? I thought that died out a long time ago.
Not in Portland. Portland is a city where young people go to retire.
This is a song from Portlandia. My guests are Fred Armisen and Carrie Brownstein, the creators and stars of the show. Welcome to Fresh Air. So,
hi.
Hi. So what does Portland signify to you? I mean, there are certain types of characters in the show. Portland isn't the only place that they exist, but what do you want Portland to signify?
I think Portland kind of encapsulates this sort of an incessant optimism. And Portland's a city, I think, that feels pretty good about itself, but it's very sensitive. People go to very extreme measures to show how nice they are.
And Carrie, you live in Portland. Fred, you live in New York, but visit Portland a lot. So what does it mean to you?
I'm there really often. I'm there for all of the summer and for the past couple of years. I've been going there for a long time. But to me, it's like a dreamy, solid place. Like I feel very safe there. I feel like all the buildings are really just like well built. And it's also overcast. So it's just nice walking around in like a jacket and nice thick shoes.
So in the song that we just heard, there's the line, you know, where the tattoo ink never runs dry. So I thought, what a perfect time to get you both to confess about the tattoos that you have.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my gosh. Well, Fred has nothing to confess.
Yeah, I have zero.
Really?
I actually,
you used to be in a band, Fred. You were a drummer.
Yeah, for some reason, I just never wanted to get one. I never got one.
And Carrie, I guess you do have something to confess about.
I guess, yeah. This is, you know, I've never been asked this question. I have three tattoos, actually. One of them, it's so boring. It's like telling people about tattoos is like worse than telling people about your dreams.
Go ahead. Just tell us.
Okay. Well, one is I have three tattoos, but I will only tell you about one of them. I was in this band for many years called Slater Kinney, and we had an album called Dig Me Out, and I have those words tattooed on my side, like on my rib cage. Very painful spot to get a tattoo, it turns out. I don't like tattoos where people can see them, which does not to say that I want tattoos in really weird places either, but I don't actually like seeing tattoos like on me, you know, next to like an outfit that I'm wearing.
You have a very funny sketch about that. Carrie, you play somebody, you know, who's been like seeing this guy, and then you notice, you know, you're getting to know him, and you notice he has a tattoo of Eddie Vedder playing two tambourines. And your reaction is, oh, that's so high school. I got over him in high school. And then you're seeing another guy and notice that he has a tattoo. Oh, who is it? The tattoo.
Ani DiFranco.
Yeah, Ani DiFranco with a nose ring. And of course, that guy is Eddie Vedder. The actor playing the guy is Eddie Vedder. So I thought that was very funny.
Yeah.
It's a real thing. I mean, as we were doing research, we found online people have tattoos of everybody.
But the thing is that she can't date somebody who has a tattoo of an artist who she is not interested in. You know, or
right. Well, actually, I am a fan of Pearl Jam and of Eddie Vedder. I think the idea is that people would like to think that they aren't shallow and that they don't have these deal breakers. But something like a bad tattoo it almost intrudes upon the relationship, and that's kind of what happens in the sketch. And even though you might like the band, it's like you wonder why would somebody get someone else's face tattooed on their body. That to me, there's you think, what in that moment were they thinking?
Have either of you ever met somebody who had a tattoo of you on their body?
I have.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Tell us about that. That's so weird.
It's one of those things because, of course, the reaction is to be flattered. Do you know what I mean? Like, you just think that is a level of commitment that I've never made to anyone. And you've made that to me, and we're strangers. So there's a real disconnect there. And you are grateful, but also a little weirded out, I will say. And you're thinking, wow, that picture, that version of me, you want to just slowly update it. You're like, oh, gosh, you got the hair wrong. Just go in there and just take a little pen and change it.
So let's hear another sketch from Portlandia. So two of the recurring characters in Portlandia are two women who own a feminist bookstore. Mm-hmm. And Fred, you play one of those two women. And of course, Carrie, you play the other. And they're very dogmatic. And in this sketch, the air conditioning is broken. So the air conditioning repairman has come to fix it. He's an older man and doesn't really know anything about feminism or the language of feminism, as this sketch shows.
Okay, sweetie, you got a burned out condenser.
Who's sweetie?
Well, ma'am, I can fix it. That's probably put a couple of new...
Sweetie, I have a name, and that name is Candace.
All right, ma'am. Well, I'm
It's
here...
not ma'am. It's Candace.
And I'm Tony.
I'm Brian. I'm Brian, the air conditioner repairman.
Okay, Brian, we're going to lend you a book. I want you to read this. And it is a vivid, vivid description of what it's like to be a woman.
Which I think is something that you could benefit from. Understanding a woman's journey, which is why I've also brought this book. Inside each of us is both a phallus and the opposite of a phallus.
A cone.
Oh, no, I've never been that way.
What way?
It's not this way or that way. We're all one way. We're all human.
You, sir, have a feminine side, don't you?
Well, I like gals.
That's really funny. That's Fred Armisen and Carrie Brownstein in a sketch from the new season of Portlandia, and the season starts Friday on IFC. How did you create these two characters, the feminist bookstore owners?
One of the first times I went to Portland, I just found this bookstore called In Other Words, and it was like I remember on the sign it said a non-for-profit feminist bookstore, and I thought that was a lot of words to put on a sign. And something about the place, there were just so many signs everywhere, and there were just a lot of rules for being in there that I just kind of liked it. I just kind of liked how anti-customer it was. So, but it's a store, you know, or they want you to buy books. So little by little, that's just one of the first things we thought of to do a sketch about. We just thought, like, well, what can we do? What would the people who work there, what would they be like? And then I remember thinking that many people in Portland have let their gray hair fly. Like, people are proud of their gray hair. It's kind of a really nice thing. So we just got these wigs, and that was one of the first pieces we did, even before Portlandia and Thunder Ant, this other project that we did leading up to it. And then it just went from there. And then we actually shoot in the store, in other words. That we're in the actual feminist bookstore, and they've been nothing but nice to us. So
they're not offended that you're mocking them, or at least they're the basis of your material? They're the inspiration?
Yeah, they're not. I think what we've kind of infused these characters with is, you know, they could really be anyone. We just thought, well, let's have these protagonists that are these awesome feminists, and they, you know, if a bookstore like that, you would think would be highly inclusive. But as we find with many of the characters on the show, you know, sometimes the things that claim to be the most inclusive have all these esoteric rules that you have to follow in order to be part of that group, that it becomes so alienating and exclusive. And so Tony and Candace, to me, just represent that completely. And I love how kind of complicated and nasty they can get. But they're also, you know, they're very fun. And also, you know, the women and men that volunteer at that bookstore, I mean, they have a sense of humor. So, yeah, we feel okay.
So if you're just joining us, my guests are Fred Armisen and Carrie Brownstein, and together they do the show Portlandia, a sketch comedy show. How did you start doing sketch comedy together?
Well, we became friends, and then I would go to Portland to visit Carrie, and somehow it just started happening where, in the same way that some people would kind of get together to play music, we just thought, like, oh, let's just make videos.
What did you do with them at first?
I mean, we didn't even have a website.
No, we just had them.
Yeah, I think we would email, you know, a link of the video to our friends, and they were mostly for us. It was a very organic process, and, you know, very understated and silly, and we were just kind of reveling in the absurd and these kind of moments of discomfort that were very sort of appealing and interesting to us. Eventually, we had a little website. And that's when we really started to get a sense of how many we had done. You know, eventually we had 10, 12 videos, and it really felt like something we wanted to pursue more deliberately, which is when we started thinking about Portlandia.
That was the thing about the early videos, too. It was nice not having the pressure of it having to be funny. I don't even know what genre it would even go in. It was more just odd, you know, but we didn't think of punchlines. We didn't think of what the joke was. The characters weren't that exaggerated. They still kind of sound like us. So that was the one very liberating and fun thing about it, is that we didn't know what it was.
Well, let's hear another sketch from Portlandia. And this is a couple at an organic restaurant. And who plays the waitress in this?
Her name is Dana Milliken, and she is a local actress in Portland, Oregon. Fantastic actor. We utilize about 90% local actors.
Okay. So this is at an organic restaurant, and this is from season one of Portlandia. Here's Carrie Brownstein and Fred Armisen.
Hi, hello.
My name is Dana. I'll be taking care of you today. If you have any questions about the menu, please let me know.
I guess I do have a question about the chicken, if you could just tell us a little bit more about it.
The chicken is a heritage breed, woodland-raised chicken that's been fed a diet of sheep's milk, soy, and hazelnuts.
Okay, this is local?
Yes, absolutely.
I'm going to ask you just one more time, and it's local?
It is.
Is that USDA organic or Oregon organic or Portland organic?
It's just all across the board, organic.
So the hazelnuts, these are local?
How big is the area where the chickens are able to roam free?
I'm sorry to interrupt. I have exactly the same question.
4 acres. Mm-hmm. Give me just a second. I'll be right back, okay?
Okay.
Okay.
Great.
She's nice.
Well, you're doing the right thing.
I'm too apologetic.
You are.
I drove way too slow here today, didn't I?
Yeah.
I'm so weird with that gas pedal. The thing just moves the whole vehicle forward.
All right, so here is the chicken you'll be enjoying tonight.
You have this information. This is fantastic.
Absolutely. His name was Colin. Here are his papers, okay?
That's great. He looks like a happy little guy who runs around. A lot of friends, other chickens as friends. Putting his little wing around another one and kind of like palling around.
I don't know that I can speak to that level of intimate knowledge about him. They do a lot to make sure that their chickens are very happy.
It's kind of like you're adopting a child instead of having dinner.
Yeah.
And I'll point out, whenever people ask, you know, are you making fun of people? And we always say, no, this is very much part of us. How emphatic was I about telling you how local the actors were right before you went into that clip? God, what a horrible, I mean, I'm worse. That's even worse than the sketch we just heard in terms of like, oh, Terry, we use local actors. They were born and raised in Portland. Jesus.
What do you like in restaurants?
Yeah, just watch out in a restaurant. I'm back there in the kitchen. I was like, was this chicken born on this plate? If it wasn't born on this plate, I'm not eating it.
So let me play one more sketch while we're talking about food. And this is the Allergy Day Parade. I think anybody who's ever had food sensitivities or eats with somebody who has food sensitivities will either really, really enjoy this or really hate you both. Mostly I think they'll enjoy it. So you each play, you know, like newscasters who are anchoring this parade down a street with floats and everything. It's the Allergy Day Parade, and the bleachers are virtually empty.
I am Mark Gemmer.
And I'm Linda Lawrence.
And welcome to Portland's Allergy Pride Parade.
We are here to celebrate Allergy Pride.
That's right. A lot of people called in sick.
Some people did. And we are here to celebrate them while they're at home.
Oh, lactose intolerance, an allergy to dairy. We got a little cow guy. That's a good idea.
Yeah. How bad do cows feel? Little did they know they would cause such a problem.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Coming up, we've got people who are allergic to wheat. I would like to see a day maybe 20 years from now when an allergy sufferer will be sitting in the White House. Maybe 20 years from now, 30 years, who knows? Ah, and here we have soy punks. These people are allergic to soy.
What are they yelling?
Oy, not soy. And of course, the perfect storm of allergies, pad thai.
It's peanuts, it's a very common allergy. There's also shellfish, wheat, soy. Really, for some people, a Thai restaurant is a death trap.
He represents, of course.
I love that. Pad thai, the perfect storm for allergies. So do you guys have food sensitivities? Have you kind of lived this?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's funny because I also feel proud of my allergies. But I'm allergic to avocado and walnuts and apples.
I'm allergic to soy and hazelnut. I think allergy sufferers, especially people with food allergies, they like that special attention. And I'm, as an allergy sufferer, you have that moment at the restaurant where, you know, you get to tell your story, you get a little sympathy. Everybody else at the table has heard it before. They roll their eyes. But, you know, I think a lot of what we celebrate on Portlandia is kind of the fact that it's like the inverse of the norm. Like, all the stuff that, you know, makes people like different, that's the stuff that's sort of celebrated. Like, if you're normal, if you don't have anything wrong with you, like, forget it. It's no fun.
Carrie Brownstein and Fred Armisen speaking with Terry Gross. You can hear more of their conversation, which includes Armisen talking about being on Saturday Night Live and Carrie Brownstein discussing her music career, in the longer version of this interview on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.